The World Health Organization released the bacterial priority pathogens in 2017. Listed as being of critical priority are the gram-negative bacterial infections with Cephalosporin and carbapenem resistance. In order to treat such infections, a number of beta-lactam/beta-lactamase inhibitor combinations have been considered, some old and others new. On this episode of Microbe Mail, we'll be diving into the BLBLIs and considering their appropriate use to treat resistant gram-negative infections. The basis of this episode is the publication of the guideline document, Appropriate Use of the New BLBLIs, Ceftazidime avibactam and Ceftolozane tazobactam in South Africa. This is Microbe Mail, and I'm your host, Vindana Chibabai. I'm joined by my co-host, Ruan Marais, today, and our special guest is Professor Adrian Brink, the first author of the published guideline. Morning, Ruan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks, and you?
Good morning, Vin. Good morning, Ruan.
Hi, morning, Adrian, and welcome so much to Microbe Mail. Thanks for joining us today. Adrian, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself before we head into the episode?
Sure. I'm head of medical microbiology at the division of the Department of Pathology at the University of Cape Town and of the NHLS Micro Lab at Groote Schuur Hospital and co-chair of the South African Stewardship Program on the Ministerial Advisory Committee for AMR for the time being and so forth.
It's great to have you with us today, Adrian. Thanks so much. So listeners, before we start our discussion, remember to follow us on your favorite podcast player of choice. Give us a five-star rating if you haven't done so already. And remember to share Microbe Mail with your colleagues, students, and friends. You can also follow us on social media. You'll find us on Instagram, X, Facebook, and now we're also on TikTok. So if you have any comments or questions about this content, you can contact us via email or on social media. So guys, are we ready to head into this episode?
Sure.
Good to go.
Great. So first question, Adrian, is what is a beta-lactamase inhibitor, otherwise known as a BLBLI, and how do they work?
Beta-lactamase inhibitors work by one of two primary mechanisms. They may become substrates that bind the beta-lactamase enzyme with high affinity and then form sterically unfavorable interactions such as with the acyl enzymes, or they may be also become suicide inhibitors, which permanently inactivate the enzyme through secondary chemical reactions in the active site. So they offer themselves up for hydrolysis, and the beta-lactam then goes on with killing the bacterium. So, for example, avibactam and relibactam work by the former mechanism, while sulbactam, tazobactam, clavulanic acid are suicide inhibitors, which are inactivated, leaving the beta-lactam molecule straight. Pharmacokinetic point of view, beta-lactamase inhibitors are generally renally excreted, do not undergo hepatic or GI first-pass metabolism, but the metabolism and PK properties are influenced by the co-administration with the beta-lactam, as well as the length of infusion, as most are delivered intravenously.
Okay, cool. So you touched on it briefly, but what BLBLIs are currently available, not just in South Africa, and what are the pathogens that they're really designed for or that they're most often used for?
The first generation beta-lactamase inhibitors, clavulanic acid, sulbactam, tazobactam, are all beta-lactam derivatives, and work primarily by inactivating class A and some class C serine beta-lactamases. But the newer generation, such as avibactam, vaborbactam, are based on non-beta-lactam structures, and their spectrum of inhibition is extended to KPC as an important class A carbapenemase. Despite these advances, several class D and virtually all important class B metallo-beta-lactamases are resistant to existing inhibitors. Now, best one refers to several publications, but there are lots of inhibitors that are on the pipeline, such as dolabactam, imetotazobactam, Nacubacter, Morellabacter, Taniflorbacter, Xenorbacter, and then there are also, what's the other one, Zabedadactam, Lactam, and there's several experimental drugs which are in the pipeline. So what is tricky about the whole beta-lactamase inhibitor combo scene to understand from a clinical or microbiological point of view is that all these different beta-lactamase inhibitors do not necessarily cover all the pathogens. So for example, ceftazidime avibactam may inhibit ESBLs and AMPC, KPC and OXA48, but ceftolozane tazobactam as a new beta-lactamase inhibitor only inhibits ESBLs and AMPC, not carbapenemases, while meropenem vababactam and imipenem relebactam have the same cover sort of a ceftaz avibactam, except that meropenem vababactam and imirelebactam do not cover OXA48, which is a major problem in many parts of the world. None of those actually cover MBLs, and there is some variable activity against carbapenem non-susceptible Acinetobacter, carbapenem non-susceptible Pseudomonas aeruginosa.
So that's a good summary. And if I can just remind the listeners that we'll put a link to the guideline document that was written. It's got a really nice table in there going through which pathogens and which resistance mechanisms are covered, very, very nicely summarized by Adrian today. So then can we talk about which of the BLIs are available and licensed for use in South Africa? And we can talk about the old and the new ones.
Amoxicillin, clavulanate, and piperacillin tazobactam would be the most used ones to date. And then we have ceftazidime, avibactam, and ceftolozane tazobactam. Meropenem vababactam and imipenem relebactam are not available yet. I suspect they have been submitted already for registration.
Mm-hmm.
But in those two drugs instance, I'm not sure they're going to make a difference to us because they don't cover OXA48.
Mm.
Okay. So just to help the listeners that might not be so well-versed in microbiology, which we hope MicroMail will help with, but can we maybe go into the main mechanisms of carbapenem resistance in Enterobacterales and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, just so we can highlight how these new BLIs are able to overcome some of these mechanisms and act as better drugs than, for example, the carbapenems?
Okay, well, there's obviously a difference between Enterobacterales and Pseudomonas carbapenem resistance, but in Enterobacterales, the most important mechanism of carbapenem resistance in that order is the acquisition of plasmid-mediated carbapenemases, specifically three of the four AMBLER classes. That means class A, C, and D. These are rapidly expanding globally, are proliferating at an unprecedented rate, are distributed in many species of Enterobacterales, but are dominated by Klebsiella pneumoniae. So that would be the main mechanism for Enterobacterales from a carbapenem resistance point of view. There are obviously other mechanisms as well. This evolving epidemiology may progressively complicate management, and the choice, as I mentioned earlier, of new beta-lactam and beta-lactamase inhibitors as an optimal antibiotic regimen might be difficult to attain in the presence of co-production of multiple enzymes or multiple resistant determinants. So the whole topic of the use of beta-lactamase inhibitor combinations is bound to get more complicated. Mm. Also, carbapenem resistance may, in Enterobacterales, emerge in vivo in ESBL or AMPC producing or hyperproducing Enterobacterales concurrent with mutation-derived porin lesions or loss, such as OMPK35, OMPK36, OMPC, OMPF, mm-hmm. and K37. But the carbapenemases predominate in Enterobacterales. Now, in Pseudomonas, mm-hmm. which has got a very large genome and is quite flaccid in that it can acquire lots of mutations, carbapenem resistance may emerge following sequential chromosomal mutations which affect the altering permeability and simultaneously resulting in hyperexpression of multidrug-resistant efflux pumps. I think Pseudomonas has the dubious distinction of potentially harboring the most efflux genes of all GNB. Mm. Last time I checked, there were around 40 pumps, but the best studied one from a carbapenem point of view is MEX-AB-OPRM and MEX-EF-OPRN. A critical feature of these is that different antibiotic classes may be substrates for a single pump, and that concurrent with hyperexpression of these pumps, OPRD mutants, which cause in vivo carbapenem resistance, may be selected. An equally important mechanism of resistance and a cause of multiple outbreaks globally is, as I mentioned, the ability of Pseudomonas to acquire beta-lactamases, including class A, such as KPC, class B, metallo-beta-lactamases, VIM, IM, SIMP, GIM, there are lots of them, and class D, such as OXA40 and OXA189. Of all of them, VIM has been predominant and has played a pivotal role in the spread of carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas globally. But as I mentioned, it's got a large genome. It demonstrates substantial genomic variability, although the more resistant strains, including carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas, belong to a few widely distributed disease-causing dominant clones. 90% of all antibiotic-resistant Pseudomonas strains belong to one of three high-risk clones, ST111, ST175, and ST235. Now, the new beta-lactamase inhibitors are able to overcome some of these mechanisms better than carbapenems or piperacillin-tazobactam because they inhibit many carbapenemases except the VIM and other metallo-beta-lactamases, or are not substrates for efflux pumps. Neither are they affected by border mutations.
Yeah, that was a really good summary. So the one thing that we haven't touched on is the AMPCs, and if we can discuss that in a little bit more detail. Can you explain to our listeners what is inducible resistance and how that differs from derepression of an AMPC or plasmid-mediated AMPC expression?
Now, this is probably one of the most complicated topics of all when it comes to beta-lactamases, but I'll go through it hopefully in a logical way.
Great.
First of all, by way of introduction, AMPC-producing organisms are quite unique, given the scarcity of clinical data to provide definitive answers, as well as enormous confusion that results from the initial susceptibility reports. Complicating matters is that the available rapid diagnostic tests do not differentiate between AMPC expression levels or do they detect plasmid-mediated AMPC genes. So clinicians have to rely on the empirical knowledge to choose the most appropriate antibiotics for sick patients. Even more perplexing is the available primary literature demonstrates conflicting data for optimal treatment, specifically cefepime versus piperacillin-tazobactam, which I'm going to come to now.
Mm.
So let's look at what are... how would one define AMPC beta-lactamases? AMPC resistance can be classified basically into three categories. You have inducible chromosomal resistance that emerges in vivo when in the presence of a beta-lactam compound, these genes are expressed. So it's an in vivo phenomenon. They might appear sensitive on the report, but in the when you prescribe certain beta-lactams, it may emerge in vivo during treatment.
Mm-hmm.
That's inducible. They historically were referred to as SPICE, Serratia, Pseudomonas, indole positive proteus, Morganella, Porphyridentia, Redgeri and Stuartae, Citrobacter, Enterobacter, but there have been some other suggestions, which I'll come to now, of a new acronym.
Mm-hmm.
The second way AMPC works is stable derepression, because of mutations in the AMPC regulatory genes. For example, certain E. coli and Shigella have a stable derepression because of mutations in the control gene of the AMPC gene. And then thirdly, the presence of plasmid-mediated AMPC that produce these beta-lactamases, regardless of whether there's a beta-lactam present or not. For example, certain E. coli may have it, Klebsiella and Salmonella.
Mm.
Now, AMPC beta-lactamases are class C serine beta-lactamases that effectively hydrolyze many beta-lactams, including third-generation cephalosporins such as ceftriaxone and ceftazidime. But AMPC production levels, to make a long story short, can be summarized as either stable or inducible and vary by host pathogen. That's why it's such a complicated topic.
Mm.
Stable or constitutive AMPC production basically occurs via chromosomal derepression or plasmid gene transfer. But organisms with stable AMPC expression, E. coli, Salmonella, are more straightforward to treat because the enzymes are always present, they're not overexpressed, so clinicians can reliably pick the active agent based on the antimicrobial susceptibility testing panel.
Mm-hmm.
However, organisms harboring inducible AMPC represent a greater challenge due to the possibility of treatment-emergent resistance during treatment. Such inducible resistance can develop even after a few doses of the wrong antibiotic.
Mm.
So before I get to treatment, let's look at the acronyms to make it simple for clinicians. AMPC were initially grouped in SPACE or SPICE, I mentioned previously. SPACE, Serratia, Pseudomonas, Acinetobacter, Citro, Enterobacter. SPICE, Serratia, Providentia, Indole-positive Proteus, Citrobacter, and Enterobacter.
Mm-hmm.
But neither provide a clear answer as to which organisms are included. So contemporary knowledge now better defines inducible, clinically relevant in vivo AMPC production in mainly three bugs: Enterobacter cloacae, mm-hmm. Citrobacter freundi, and Klebsiella erogenous, formerly known as Enterobacter erogenous. The acronym developed then includes ECK. Now, inducible resistance in vivo have been reported with a range of about 80 to 40% for these three pathogens specifically: Enterobacter cloacae, I repeat, Citrobacter freundi, and Klebsiella erogenous. Now, the two other bugs, they're less commonly encountered, but still considered clinically relevant, as Hafnia alveae and Yersinia enterocolitica. So putting these terms together, it's been suggested to update the acronym to HECYES, which means it includes, I know, it's going to go on evolving.
Well, people will remember it.
Hafnia alveae and Yersinia, meaning H and yes. Okay. This has been proposed, but more accurately describes the pathogens that clinicians potentially should commit to memory, with the main focus on Enterobacter cloacae, Citrobacter freundi, and Klebsiella erogenous. If you do see Hafnia alveae and so on. So the heck yes is more supposed to be more clinically relevant, but that's a suggestion. When it comes to treatment, it's really complicated. So historically, carbapenems have been regarded as the primary therapeutic choice, but a suitable alternative is needed due to the rise of carbapenem-resistant bugs.
Mm.
Now, in contrast, piperacillin, tazobactam, and cefepime are potential directed therapeutic options, directed based on susceptibility result in the treatment of inducible AMPC-producing bacteria that were shown to be susceptible to either two.
Mm.
What's nice about piperacillin and tazobactam, they are weak inducers of the AMPC beta-lactamase compared to ceftriaxone or ceftazidime. Cefepime has the advantage of being a weak inducer while actually withstanding hydrolysis of AMPC beta-lactamase. So if it is expressed, even if it's a weak inducer, it is not hydrolyzed by the AMPC. It's stable
mm-hmm.
because it forms a stable isocyl enzyme complex. Now, although developed as a beta-lactamase inhibitor, tazobactam is not effective in vitro for inhibiting AMPC hydrolysis, which theoretically makes piperacillin a less desirable choice on paper. But consensus, depending on where you are in the world, experts abroad particularly favor cefepime over piperacillin and tazobactam, based on what I just said, based on recent clinical data. But the bottom line is there's never been a head-to-head comparison in a proper randomized controlled trial. And so the evidence is less than conclusive.
Mm.
So as such, the available clinical evidence does not support the use of alternative agents over piperacillin or cefepime, nor that resistance should be inferred. That means reporting an agent as resistant based on the antibiogram or on the biogram based on AMP-C phenotype.
Mm.
If piperacillin and tazobactam or cefepime is susceptible in vitro, they've got to be reported as they are tested.
Mm.
That means that these two drugs for such bugs can be used as directed therapy. Now, given their non-inferior efficacy compared to meropenem, cefepime could be prioritized for ECK pathogens whenever the suspicion of ESBL co-production is low. And this is really the problem,
mm.
in that AMP-C is often, as we saw in Marino, published or co-produced with ESBLs.
Right.
While piperacillin tazobactam may be a viable alternative for treating non-critically ill patients amongst those showing evidence of clinical improvement. So, to make a long story short, and the lab has got to come to the party, when Enterobacterales isolate exhibit cefepime dose-dependent susceptibility or MIC of between 4 and 8, carbapenem should be a better alternative. A related question, seeing me talking about Blix, what about the availability of novel beta-lactamase inhibitors? Imipenem, celastin, relibactam, meropenem, vibrobactam, ceftolozane, tazobactam, cefcaz, avibactam, as well as some other newer beta-lactamases that are stable against AMP-C hydrolysis. What role could these play in the treatment of invasive infections, particularly empirically, if you could afford them? We don't know yet. But both imipenem, relibactam, and meropenem, vibrobactam are novel carbapenemase inhibitor combinations, and their ability between these two to complicate matters is to withstand AMP-C hydrolysis is not the same. Relibactam is a very good AMP-C inhibitor, but vibrobactam is not. So regardless, adding a novel inhibitor to a carbapenem, you know, is really necessary for ECK pathogens because carbapenem alone retain potent in vitro activity against both AMP-C and ESBLs. But I think that both should be reserved, these new beta-lactamase inhibitor combos, for life-threatening infections caused by organisms demonstrating carbapenem resistance. So to make this long, complicated story short, in conclusion, the challenge in demystifying inducible AMP-C in vivo is far from over. Clinicians must evaluate patient-specific mm-hmm. and infection-specific factors when managing AMP-C with the help of your friendly clinical microbiologist or ID. ECK pathogens are the most notable clinical isolates with AMP-C induction potential, and first-line agents such as cefepime or carbapenem need to be prioritized for treating serious infection. Many important questions remain, and I think we eagerly look forward to future large-scale randomized control studies to settle the so-called amped-up debate. Until then, it is reasonable, I think, to base treatment options as per the guideline we wrote for mm-hmm. AMP-C producers on in vitro susceptibility report without fiddling with inferring resistance or not, the site of infection, clinical status, drug dosing, administration strategies that are enhanced, source control, and close monitoring to evaluate clinical response.
Wow, okay, that was quite a masterclass on AMP-Cs.
A very nice brief masterclass. So that was excellent, Adrian. Thank you so much.
I hope we didn't confuse the listener further.
No. I mean, it's a confusing topic, but I think that was very clear. But I think we'll stick with the controversial topics and talk about talk about another very, very controversial issue, and that is piperacillin tazobactam for ESBL producers. Any thoughts on, you know, should we, shouldn't we? And if we do, when?
To me, the ESBLs are a little bit simpler than AMP-C because we have better data. So piperacillin tazobactam remains really active in vitro against a considerable proportion of ESBL-producing pathogens. Now, in most countries abroad, first world, wealthy, they discard any use of piperacillin, but we don't have a choice to position them appropriately. Having said that, the use of non-carbapenem beta-lactamase for the treatment of ESBLs have yielded conflicting and controversial results. Based on previous comparative studies and reviews that reported the potential role in the treatment of serious ESBL, piperacillin appeared to be a reasonable option for low to moderate severity infection in non-critically ill patients, infections that result from urinary or from biliary sources, and infections with a PIP-TAS MIC less than 4. I think that PIP-TAS may be a carbapenem-sparing agent for bloodstream infections as directed therapy if the criteria are met, the dose is optimized, and response to treatment is closely monitored. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely it does, yeah.
That was nice and clear.
In a high-severity infection in a critically ill patient, in an infection resulting from pneumonia or HAP, or if the MIC is above 4, you've got to stick to the carbapenems. There won't be carbapenem sparing. The other option, if we perhaps get the new beta-lactamase inhibitors cheaper or they lose patent, would be to consider tolazone tazobactam or ceftaz avibactam as they are active against ESBLs.
Right. So, Adrian, can we talk about the South African in-hospital epidemiology of difficult-to-treat gram-negatives and which may benefit from the new BLIs? And also if we could talk about whether this differs between the various provinces of South Africa. So if we could look at this question from two perspectives, one from the carbapenem-resistant Enterobacterales and second as the carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosus isolates, please.
Yeah, so per definition, the difficult-to-treat resistance in GMBs would mean resistance to all first-line treatments. So one of the three carbapenems is resistant, cefepime, the cephalosporins, fluoroquinolones, etc. So based on recent surveillance for CRE, bloodstream infections, it doesn't vary that much, except in KZN where dual-producing serratia appear to have emerged. We're also seeing one of our hospitals in Cape Town seeing a lot of serratia-producing carbapenemases. But when I say dual-producing, it's where serratia is producing OXA48 and NDM in KZN. Otherwise, I don't think, you know, the data differs that much for in-hospital. The predominant bug is always OXA48 followed by NDM.
Right.
And then there are slight differences for species distribution, but Klebs pneumo accounts for the majority of infections, more or less about 80%. Mm-hmm. Then Enterobacter, serratia, and E. coli at around 5 to 6, 7%. Recently, it was reported that colistin resistance in these bugs, particularly Klebs pneumo, is around 18%. It looks like from an in-hospital point of view that the median age across the provinces is about, for acquisition, it's about 33 years, with the overall in-hospital mortality rate, which differs slightly across the provinces of about, 35%. Mm. The risk factors on multivariate logistical regression are well known. The LD patients, comorbidities such as diabetes, malignancy, if you have altered mental state on admission or during hospital, and always previous antibiotic use.
Mm.
What's interesting for South Africa, and again, it differs a little bit, is the distribution of genes. The majority, about 80%, you have one carbapenemase gene, but in about 4%, we see, depending on where you are, more than one carbapenemase gene. It also worries me that based on the recent data, in about 12% of CRE, no carbapenemase gene is detected, and we're not looking enough in detail what those mechanisms of resistance are and what the clinical implications are. But as I said, OXA48 around 75 to 80%, followed by MDM, about 20% of isolates, and then VIM and GES and so on around 1%. It's not common. KPC is rarely seen, although I heard there are some reports of increase in Gauteng and so on. So when we look at carbapenem resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa, as far as I know, no national surveillance, as I mentioned now, for Enterobacterales for Pseudomonas is currently performed. And so it really varies between institutions pending patient profile. So if you have a cystic fibrosis clinic, you do a lot of lung transplants, you have burns unit in your hospital, you have hemoncology, you will see more or less of carbapenem resistant Pseudomonas. While the focus on genealogy or gene carbapenemase genes have mainly been focusing on Enterobacterales, it's increasingly important to perform genotypic description of carbapenem-resistant or Pseudomonas aeruginosa carbapenemases. Example, if VIM is the main cause of carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas, it precludes the use of ceftolozane tazobactam in many institutions. If you don't have VIM, but you have an OXA-producing Pseudomonas, or even a KPC-producing Pseudomonas, you can actually use ceftaz avibactam from a new BLIC point of view.
Okay. And I think you touched briefly on treatment, but with what we currently have in South Africa, what would be the recommendations for using BLBLIs for CREs and carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas aeruginosa?
I think it would, for Pseudomonas, depend on the site of infection. And for the CREs as well. But in order to preserve the activity of ceftaz, I'm going to do them separately, ceftaz avibactam, it's recommended to restrict its use to the treatment of serious infection caused by difficult to treat CRE that is resistant to all beta lactams, including carbapenems. That means that this is based on susceptibility results. So it's more directed therapy and not empirical therapy, although in some instances one should probably consider using it earlier. If you use rapid genotypic testing and we get our act together, you can actually get away from empirical treatment if the patient isn't ill and only use directed treatment if you can confirm the presence of OXA48, KPC, GES in serious infections, where the MIC to meropenem are more than 8 and ceftaz avibactam indicates susceptibility. I also think serious infection where a patient has clinically failed combination carbapenem therapy, such as meropenem plus colistin, in spite of adequate source control. And then there are other indications, perhaps, which we don't understand well yet, is how to use ceftaz AB in combination with aztreonam when a patient tests, when a serious infection caused by organisms that test positive for OXA48 plus NDM, such as we see in Sriracha in KZN. This issue of ceftaz avibactam plus aztreonam, one needs to relook at this carefully. I've got a funny feeling, and this is based on anecdotal results, case reports, that ceftaz avi alone even might work, even if it is an NDM. And I'm not sure how we're going to one day down the line. We need the clinical data to look at the combination with aztreonam. Similarly, in order to preserve the efficacy of ceftolozane tazobactam, we should be restricted where ceftolozane tests susceptible. This is very important, particularly in Pseudomonas. If you have a VIM, it's going to be resistant. So these would be treatment of critically ill patients with HAP/VAP, the confirmed difficult to treat bug, or even a HEC, yes, Enterobacterolis, that is carbapenem resistant, a complicated interabdominal infection with a difficult to treat Pseudomonas, and then bloodstream infections with difficult to treat Pseudomonas. So the guideline committee felt we should try and reserve ceftaz-avi for treatment in carbapenemase-producing bugs and try and use ceftolozone-tazobactam for Pseudomonas aeruginosa. But because ceftaz-avi is also active against carbapenem-resistant Pseudomonas or difficult-to-treat Pseudomonas, in many instances, if a Pseudomonas is going to produce one of the OXAs or KPC, you might actually use ceftaz-avi in this setting as well.
Yeah, that was a good summary and a nice explanation around it as well. So Adrian, we know that in some parts of South Africa, particularly in the public sector, there's limited access to these new BLIs. And we've also got listeners from other low and middle income countries who may have a similar problem in terms of limited access. So if limited access precludes use as you've recommended, what would your thoughts be on optimal use of these agents where you perhaps have limited number of courses per month or limited availability?
Yeah, this is a very tricky question, but I think to make, you know, one can summarize it, I think in life-threatening infections, upon microbiological failure, remaining bloodstream infections remain positive, failure of preferred antibiotic choices. So the patient is on high-dose meropenem as a prolonged infusion in combination with colistin, or where you have colistin non-susceptibility, one should leverage acquisition, particularly of ceftaz-avibactam, as directed therapy via a multidisciplinary team decision and also close monitoring by the same team. That would be microbiological failure or preferred choices such as high-dose meropenem in combo with colistin or colistin non-susceptibility. Mm-hmm. And then it's easier if the decision is leveraged to management via a multidisciplinary team, which can also then closely monitor the duration of use.
Absolutely.
Okay. So then looking at it from entirely the other perspective, if these drugs, let's say ceftaz-avi and ceftolozane-tazobactam, become readily available, the costs come down, do you see them still being used in the same way as a directed last resort therapy, or do you see them potentially becoming carbapenem sparing agents?
Yeah, this is a double-edged sword, because while there may be a role for ceftolozane-tazobactam or ceftaz-avi in serious ESBL or MC-producing infections, as carbapenem-sparing choices, I think empirical use should be avoided if possible, because we have seen, particularly in KPC, rapid development of in vivo resistance already seen with both, even after short courses. There are lots of reports in the literature, large reports, where resistance to these two new beta-lactamase inhibitors develops rapidly. So my gut feeling would be to avoid it empirically if possible. However, I think one should consider earlier switch to these beta-lactamase inhibitors as directed therapy in very sick patients, particularly upon clinical and microbiological failure of preferred choices. We had a case at Red Cross which had a sirasha producing OXA 48 and was treated for 3 weeks of burns, a child with burns. Hafsat Tutla wrote this up. And for 3 weeks, they pussyfooted and continued with high dose meropenem and then colistin became, that kind of thing. When they switched to ceftaz-avi, the patient responded within 48 hours and remained negative. They are very potent anti-carbapenemase-producing agents, or ceftaz-avi is. So I think depending on the severity of illness, one could consider this earlier, but it would depend on the multidisciplinary team. There are people that feel that you should combine ceftaz-avi with colistin or in combination with some other drug, but I think that the drug on its own is potent enough if dosed appropriately in patients with renal compromise or renal failure or not.
Yeah, absolutely. So along those lines of empiric use and appropriate use, etc., that brings us to the question on antimicrobial stewardship. So which antimicrobial stewardship tools do you think would be most appropriate for trying to preserve these new BLIs at this stage, seeing as they haven't been used as frequently as the other agents?
I think some of the two key stewardship principles, for me, they are indicated for difficult to treat resistant gram negatives. So in the indications of complicated intra-abdominal infection, complicated UTI, HAP-VAP, bloodstream infections, I think for the time being, we should keep them as antibiotics of last resort. And I would discourage empirical use. My experience, once you use it empirically, they don't stop the antibiotics. So patients, for example, with complicated intra-abdominal infection, which is the biggest risk of prolonged infections, a prolonged treatment, that resistance develops very quickly. So I don't believe that a hospital should be allowed to implement use of these drugs without oversight of either ID specialist, a microbiologist, an intensivist experience in stewardship, or a team that includes the pharmacist. For me, that's the key principle. And the tool that one has is audit. It's audit the use. What are the indications? Was it directed therapy? What is the diagnosis, etc.? I'm going to shortly talk about that because there are, a panel of process measures that you could implement to audit as a stewardship tool the use of these drugs. I think for me, the biggest problem is duration. And as a stewardship principle for this and other drugs as well, there's enough evidence, even in sepsis, that procalcitonin-guided duration is advised where you have resources. Otherwise, duration should not exceed a bloodstream infection more than 7 days, even HAP 5 days. The new shorter is better stuff for catheter-associated UTIs, not more than 7. Intra-abdominal infections, not more than 4 days. And that's really the biggest challenge in stewardship, is to stop the drug early enough. Mm-hmm. And one tool to use, as per your question, would be procalcitonin-guided therapy. Procalcitonin in severe sepsis or septic shock should never be used to start antibiotics, but could be considered to stop antibiotics, even earlier than the shorter is better guideline, as Brad Spellberg has shown us. So one way and one tool would be to institute defined process and outcome measures, which is an institutional audit of new utilization. So, for example, the process measure would be, did the clinician provide justification for prescribing ceftolozane, tazobactam, or ceftazavir from a directed therapy? In other words, it's a behavior change thing, accountable justification. Deny the patient's failing, so boom, there we go. We just prescribe it. Or do we actually have justification properly? And then from a directed therapy, was it prescribed based on laboratory confirmed difficult to treat the carbapenemase production? Was it prescribed for other laboratory confirmed gram negatives like HEC? Yes. Or did we actually do an MIC, an e-test? Was that recorded? These are things we don't do. If it was given empirically, was it based on defined risk factors for difficult to treat Enterobacterales? And were appropriate cultures obtained? Another audit which you could do, depending on your team, is de-escalate. Was the drug, the beta-lactamase inhibitor, ceftazavir or ceftolozane, de-escalated once susceptibility report became available? And did you actually start with a more narrow spectrum? I think that the dosing should be audited for renal impairment and the prescribed dosing according to PK principles in HAP and VAP and so on. Also, in complicated intra-abdominal, should one add metronidazole? This is a bit of a controversial one. And then you could audit the duration. And then there's several outcome measures you could look at if you have the resources or the data. All-cause mortality, 30-day attributable, clinical success, failure, microbiological failure, length of stay, and so on.
Mm.
Hope that makes sense.
That's, I think, a great starting point for anyone, for any institution or team that's looking at the implementing AMS tools in their site. So, I mean, looking at what we're trying to avoid using all of these tools, new BLBLI resistance, are we seeing that yet in South Africa and globally?
There are unpublished reports from a few South African institutions indicate substantial Kefalosin tazobactam resistance in Pseudomonas. This is due to MBLs, mainly Vim, but it's very institution specific. Otherwise, Ceftolozin tazobactam is active against most Pseudomonas and ESBLs. There are unconfirmed resistance to Ceftaz avibactam in OXA 48 among CPE, but I have not seen those bugs and I haven't seen a proper port of it. There are globally more data for Ceftaz avibactam for the KPC variants. The KPC variants are developing resistance to Ceftaz avi at a massive rate. Because we don't see KPC, we haven't actually seen those variants, but we need better genomic surveillance. And if people do find OXA48, it's got to be stored and it's got to be studied. But at this stage, for OXA48, we don't have any reports published of Ceftaz avibactam resistance.
That's good news for now, at least.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it's just a matter of time. So, Adrian, on the podcast, we try to include all age groups in our discussions. So the next question then is whether these drugs are approved for use in children and neonates. And if not, is there any data on actually using them in this patient population?
Yeah, well, so Ceftaz avibactam as a BLIC was approved by the FDA and many other organizations in 2019 for children aged more than 3 months. There isn't enough data for neonates, but there have been a randomized controlled trial for ceftolozin tazobactam as a safe and effective new treatment option, active against resistant, difficult to treat resistant gram negatives for children, including neonates and young infants with UTIs. In 2022, I'm not sure about our local authority, but the FDA approved ceftolozin tazobactam for the treatment of the following infections with susceptible bugs in adult and pediatric. That means birth to 18 months old, complicated intra-abdominal in combination with metronidazole, and complicated UTIs, including pyelonephritis. So typically, unfortunately, the children and the neonates always follow adult registration trials. But at least for ceftolozin tazobactam, we have very good data from a neonatal point of view, which I think is important. The data for Ceftaz avi is forthcoming. But having said that, people are using it, of course, off-label in life-threatening infections.
Great. Well, that's useful to know.
Yeah. And then just to end, BLICs are such a broad and rapidly evolving topic, as we've come to realize through this episode. There are just so many nuanced concepts and important provisos in using various drugs. So is there any topic that is of personal interest, or maybe a topic that you feel is really important to highlight to any of our listeners in this space?
Yes, I think there are few in this complicated, evolving topic. I think that we need rapid genotypic characterization of Carbapenem Pseudomonas as well, not only Enterobacterolus, as the distribution of the carbapenemase enzymes will affect efficacy of current and new BLICs in the pipeline. There's no doubt that as we get more of these new beta-lactamase inhibitor combinations, we need to understand what carbapenemases is Pseudomonas aeruginosa producing, as well as the carbapenemase producing Enterobacterolus, of course. So in this regard, if we optimize ID and susceptibility testing, I think with effective rapid genotyping, we can move away from empirical antibiotic use for or of Blix to directed therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You can, within 3 or 4 hours, have confirmation of what the carbapenemase gene is, and then you can choose according to what it is. I also finally think that equally important is, where's the evidence that carbapenem sparing regimens actually work? This is a very nuanced concept. Everybody's on carbapenem sparing. They would usually use tazobactam than ertapenem, but ertapenem's got no collateral damage in Pseudomonas, but piptaz does. So how do you do carbapenem sparing? What has the outcome been? What's the best way? Restrict ertapenem with a narrow spectrum that doesn't affect non-fermenters in favor of piperacillin tazobactam, which does affect both enterobacterolis and non-fermenters. These are the three topics I am particularly interested in learning further. Specifically, if we do finally, the fourth one, find OXA48 that are resistant to ceftaz avibactam, then we need to understand what the mechanism of resistance would be.
Great. Thanks, Adrian. So we're coming to the end where I'm going to ask you for a brief take-home message.
Yes, I think the brief take-home message for me would be that every institution needs to know what bugs they have, what's the epidemiology. You can't go on national guidelines, European guidelines. You need to know, what does your Pseudomonas look like? What is your syndromic antibiogram? And that is the key to all of it. I think the take-home message is that we need to really get our acts together and introduce rapid genetic testing on isolates, particularly in patients who are severely ill. And we need it not only for enterobacterolis, but also for Pseudomonas aeruginosa. Those would be the two main ones. Know your bugs, know your syndromic antibiogram, and work within a multidisciplinary environment to decide what's best for your institution. If you don't do that, you can't go at it alone as an ID doctor, or a clinician, or a pharmacist, or a microbiologist. It's a team sport, diagnostic stewardship.
Absolutely. Great. That's very, very valuable. Adrian, thank you so much for joining us today. It was an incredibly insightful conversation, and I'm very certain it's going to be useful to the clinicians who are managing resistant gram-negative infections on a regular basis in South Africa, and also in other low middle income countries where access to these newer agents might be quite limited. So thank you so much for joining us. It was great to have you on, and I hope we'll be able to get you on again sometime soon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. I hope I didn't confuse any microbiologists, ID doctors, or clinicians further.
I think you've definitely unscrambled things.
Thank you. Take care. Bye.
Listeners, let us know your thoughts, comments, and suggestions on email or on social media. And until next time, that's it from all of us, your microbe messengers. That's Vin, Ruan, Vinita, Nongs, Fatima, and Esther. We'll see you again soon with more Contagious Mail.